Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
And this is Dr. Peter Bregan. You can Google it. Get another study showing that amphetamines, when given to children, have no good long-term effect. This study focused on the issue of academics. No difference between the kids on the drugs and off the drugs who had a diagnosis of ADHD. Well, what a surprise. Back in 1991 in Toxic Psychiatry, 1991, I wrote that all the studies indicate that there are no long-term positive effects of any kind from taking stimulant drugs, but a horrendous number of potentially disastrous adverse effects, suppression of height and weight and overall growth, almost inevitable. Suppression of emotions and development, personal development of the child. Psychosis, tics, obsessive compulsive disorder, commonly depression. And perhaps worst of all, when children get these drugs, they become less of themselves. They're less able to relate socially. They're just overall suppressed in their behavior. Even if they look good, they ain't as good as they would have been. And there's no way of measuring how much of their potential has been lost. And invariably, they're going to believe they're defective when they're not. They're going to believe they have a disorder, ADHD, when there is none. They're going to think that the power to control themselves lies outside themselves, not even in their parents and teachers, but outside their parents and teachers. That the power to control lies in the doctor and a pill. It's a disaster. It's a disaster. A huge chunk, maybe 20% or more of our high schoolers on these drugs. And this is a growing worldwide epidemic, an iatrogenic, a doctor-induced epidemic. And the kids who have this diagnosis of ADHD, what's their problem? Well, their problem is that if they fit the diagnosis, is that they're undisciplined. That is, they're not able to control themselves well, to focus on their studies, or to be disciplined, or to listen in class. If they have a problem, that's their problem. In other words, they need help growing up. But many of them don't even have that problem. Many of them are just bored or abused, misfits in their classrooms. And every child, every single child needs one thing, adult attention, wise, loving adult attention. That's what every child needs. I don't care whether you're going to diagnose them as autistic or consider them super-duper normal. What children need to grow up is wise, loving adult attention. There's no way around it. Children need us. And whatever their problems, however serious, then they need more of us and better of us. And it's up to us to rise to the occasion of our children's needs. Well, I don't know what's going to happen in terms of study after study. It's just been established over and over again now that these drugs are causing disastrous harm. They're gateway drugs to drug addiction, to delinquency, to becoming a chronic psychiatric patient, a career shortened in years by the drugs as a psychiatric patient. But is the profession listening? No, it is not. No, it's not. This additional study a very reputable, large-scale study showing no good academic effect. It's not going to affect the pediatricians, the psychiatrists, the GPs, the family docs giving out these drugs and making these diagnoses. The only thing that's going to ultimately affect them is an uprising from the public, from families, saying no more drugging our kids. I think that's the only place it's going to come from. And that's what I encourage. Parents, teachers, ministers, coaches, take a stand. Our kids need us. They don't need drugs. I think my guest today is going to be in agreement with me. Vicki, are you there?
I'm here, Peter. And I certainly am in agreement with you. It's lovely to speak with you.
My guest is Vicki Kopok. That's spelled C-O-P-P-O-C-K. She's speaking to us from Great Britain. She's a reader in social sciences, childhood studies, and mental health in the social science department at Edge Hill University in Lancaster. Did I pronounce that right? Lancaster? Is that what it is?
Actually, it's in Lancashire. It's
Lancashire. All I got was the L-A. Yes, Lancashire.
Yeah, it's one of our shires in the UK. a little town called Ormskirk in Lancashire.
I was having trouble with it, Vicki.
Uh-huh.
You can Google her if you want better information. You can Google Vicki Kopok. Vicki was originally trained, got a sociology degree, a BA, and then a social work degree, and completed her studies in crime and deviant social policy. She comes from a working class background. She's been interested in the poor. She's been interested in children. When she moved out into her therapy practice, she found, like all of us do, that the training wasn't really going to help, that she had to find ways of actually addressing the real needs of people. I became acquainted with her working across the continents, the ocean, on a special issue of a journal, Children and Society, called Psychiatrized Children. Children and Society, she's a co-editor of that special issue, and I got to work with her in that manner. And partially as a result of our relationship, I have an article that will be coming out in there, in which I say it's time to be working toward a ban on giving psychoactive drugs to children. Time to be working in that direction. That's where we want to go. And then I'm, I think, third author or so on an article calling for a ban on ECT for children, electroshock for children. How's that for a radical conclusion? Welcome to the show, Vicki.
Thank you, Peter. It's an absolute pleasure to be here. And yes, it's incredible, really, because I think that you've not known me very long, but I feel as if I've known you for a very long time. I've been very familiar with your work for a long, long time, and it's had a great influence on me as a person and in my role, both as a practitioner and as an academic over many years. So to be speaking with you on your show about these matters that concern both of us, matters that are not just about how we think about these things intellectually, but how we feel about them in our conscience. That really is a privilege for me to be doing that with you today. So thank you for inviting me.
Well, Vicki, thank you very much for that, as well as the opportunity to co-author and author two articles in the upcoming issue. You know, Vicki, one of the things that's been given to me from doing this radio show that was totally unexpected was to invite interesting people onto the show, people doing worthwhile work, and to find out that 2 days beforehand in a phone call conversation and sometimes even on the show that my work has mattered to them over the years. It's been really, really gratifying, and I thank you very much for that. Tell us about your work. Start from wherever you would like.
Okay, yeah. I think I'd just like to briefly start by picking up on something that you'd said earlier from when you introduced me and my background. And initially, it's about the fact of when I first came to, if you like, lose some faith in psychiatry and psychology. And it was quite early on in my career. It was at the point of training. And it was when I found myself in a situation where I was asked to go out as a young social worker, a psychiatric social worker in training. I was working with a team in a it was an outpatient facility in a hospital, a local hospital, and I was asked to go out and collate some information about the circumstances of a young boy who was only about 9, and I was asked to find out a bit more about him from the perspective of his parents and learn about his environment at home. And then, as you know, with the way this works, the little boy himself was interviewed by our consultant child and adolescent psychiatrist, and we came together as a team of people to discuss this young boy. And I was horrified by the way in which this psychiatrist essentially wrote this little boy off. He came to the conclusion that this little boy was not going to ever achieve anything in life, that he would not make friends easily, that he would invariably get into trouble, that he would drift into delinquency, and as he grew older, into crime, and that essentially we could do very little for him because the psychiatrist believed he was suffering, although he had no firm scientific proof. He believed that this boy was suffering from something that he was calling at that point minimal brain dysfunction. And I know that you will be familiar with that term, Peter, as one of the early sort of forms of terminology that we used to have to describe what is now described as ADHD. And this was, to me, such a depressing prospect to be part of a system that was so ready to give up, to not have any idea of hope at all, or to instill hope in the people that it came into contact with. And I remember being in a furious argument with my my tutor, my university tutor, about this. And I sort of had the message sent to me that, you know, that I should sort of know my place, and that you know, I was only just starting out, and these were people who knew a lot more than I did. And I sort of knuckled down, and even though I had these reservations, I continued to work in the field, and I tried desperately to make contact, if you like, with people who also had doubts and reservations about some of this. And that essentially is how my practice developed, that I fortunately was with a team of people who were not quite so willing to write children and young people off. but it was still a feeling that in the real world out there, these theories that psychiatry had given me to work with children and people who were presenting with distress were not matching. They just didn't match the reality of their lives, and they certainly didn't offer hope. More latterly, of course, we've come to recognize now that it's got worse, not better, as you said earlier, much, much worse. We're now in a situation where we have seemingly an epidemic of ADHD. And that is something that when I moved from practice into my academic career, I was very, very interested in, not just specifically ADHD, but the process by which children, young people fall prey to psychiatric diagnosis for the most innocuous of reasons. As you said, for fidgeting in class, for being not conforming in ways that adults expected of them, in particular ways, for being troublesome, for being disturbing to adults in various contexts. And the way in which it seemed to be quite arbitrary, the kinds of labels that those children and young people were then given. And then, more subsequently, the growth of drugging. I think it's, you know, that is something that certainly yourselves in the United States, I think that process started much sooner than it did here in the United Kingdom. But nevertheless, I pull down a few statistics that just to help listeners to put this in perspective. When I was researching for my article that you and I first had a conversation about, which was called, it was a chapter called Medicalizing Children's Behavior that I wrote in a handbook of children's rights, I was using ADHD as my case study to try to demonstrate the problems with medicalization, the way in which we psychiatry have that tendency to diagnose these behaviors of children as illness. And in the process of doing that, I looked up some statistics. And the statistics that we have, which are official statistics published here by our Department of Health, in terms of the dispensing of prescriptions for methylphenidate, one of the drugs that's used to treat, supposedly treat, ADHD. In 1991, the year you wrote Toxic Psychiatry or published Toxic Psychiatry, the number of prescriptions that were dispensed was 2,000. Do you know what they were in April of last year? 786,400 prescriptions. Right? Wow. I'll repeat that. From 2,000 in 1991 to 786,400 in 2012. And that is only for methylphenidate, not for the other. That's only for prescriptions that are dispensed in our National Health Service. It doesn't include private practice. And it also doesn't include the other drugs that are given now for
just,
the treatment.
Just to catch people up on, methylphenidate, of course, is Ritalin.
Michelin,
the trade name for it. Yeah. That's startling. I'd not heard that data before. Mm-hmm. So when my book came out in its English edition in the early 1990s, very comparatively few children were on these drugs.
Yeah.
And it's just escalated over the 15 years or more.
Absolutely. It's horrendous. It's absolutely horrendous. And I think what people need to think about, Peter, is what does it actually tell us? It would be so easy, and it is so easy for people to interpret that data and other data, which I'll mention in a moment, that also gives the impression, if you like, that we have a whole generations of children over the last 20 years or so that have become more disturbed. That's what that tells us. At face value, we're supposed to believe that what's happened here is that we have a whole generation of children and people who are far madder than they've ever been before. Yeah, they're crazier than they've ever been before. And that's why we're medicating them. And that very simplistic message is perpetrated extensively through media, yeah, through the way in which popular media has picked up on ADHD. It's in pop psychology magazines. It's in all sorts of ways. It filters into the consciousness of people to such a degree that they don't question it. They don't think, well, hold on a moment, that seems to be an unreasonable leap, yeah. And the other data that I wanted to cross-reference this with is, again, at the moment, I have this as UK data. We had a very high-profile study that is relied upon extensively in the UK by psychiatrists and is quoted by psychiatrists all the time, that was statistical data reporting increases in rates of diagnosable disorder in children and young people in the UK. Okay? And this was published in 2004. And basically what it reported was a 100% rise in emotional problems, conduct disorders, and stress in children in the period from the early 90s to 2004, a 100% increase. Okay. So what's going on here? Is it really that we have, so many children that are becoming more extremely disturbed? Or is it, truthfully, something else that's going on? And that's what I have principally been concerned about over that period, over these years, in the last sort of, 10 to 15
Vicky,
years.
Vicky, go ahead to answer your question best you can. What is going on here
in Great Britain and
around the world?
Well, that idea, of course, this idea that the mental health of our children and young people has deteriorated to that extent, you should be forgiven for being rather skeptical of that. And what I knew, of course, from my practice was the ease with which psychiatrists and psychologists had an inclination to diagnose. And also, this whole process that I'd been part of defining what counts as mental illness, identifying it, explaining it, that realization that this is beset with bias, okay, and that what actually we were seeing here was an increased propensity of psychiatrists to use the diagnosis. Okay, so for me, it's got nothing to do necessarily with anything that's going on in the heads of our children, young people, in terms of supposed biochemical imbalances in their brains. It's to do with social processes, the social processes that surround diagnosis, and the propensity of psychiatrists to become more inclined to diagnose. And that's what we have seen in the UK. The high profile of certain psychiatrists who have wanted to, push the diagnosis and the treatment of the diagnosis in various ways. And what concerned me most is that this has happened with, it's brought parents along with it. It's brought parents along. It's not about blaming parents. It's not about either, in truth, blaming psychiatrists. It's about seeing how this all came about in an atmosphere where people were on face value saying that they wanted to help children. They believed they were helping children. It went hand in hand with a resurgence of neuropsychiatry, a new kind of push in neuropsychiatry, and the way in which science has a certain credibility with parents was seized upon, and so many parents started to come forward to ask for a diagnosis because that, understandably, made them feel less guilty about whatever was going on. They felt guilty. They feel terrible that they have this child that they feel they don't understand. They can't make sense of this behavior. They don't feel as if they've done anything wrong as a parent, and yet their child to them seems to not be their child any longer. And there's a seductive quality to what psychiatry offers to parents when it gives a diagnosis such as ADHD. It gives parents this idea of certainty that it's nobody's fault. It's not their fault as parents. It's not the child's fault because the child has got something wrong with their brain and they can't help it either. So it absolves everybody from any sense of responsibility. And that is incredibly appealing. So this dynamic process between psychiatry offering seemingly an explanation for that behavior, parents liking the sound of that explanation, and also trusting psychiatrists, because these are people you trust. You trust doctors. Yeah? These are important people that we're told that we should trust. They tell us, and you know as well as I do, Peter, that you know the amount of research equally that people who are pro-drugging and pro-ADHD and pro-drugging will equally try to convince us of the scientific proof for the diagnosis. Parents have no capacity to weigh that evidence, perhaps in the way we can. I'm not suggesting that they're not intelligent enough to do so. I'm just suggesting in the normal, everyday course of life, it's not something necessarily that parents would do to go and you know gather all of this evidence. If they do, they find it conflicts massively. Yeah. But the truth is that this is the situation, that the jury's still out. We don't know. You know, the more we believe we know about the brain, or the more investigations we make into the brain, the more we find we don't know.
But I'm a little confused, Vicky. On what point is the jury out? Still not in?
Yeah, because there is still no proof. The idea that this is something that's proven.
The ADHD concept?
Yeah. Or
I think the jury's... Yeah. Well, Vicky, I think the jury's come in on that one. Mm-hmm. There is no such thing as ADHD as a clinical, medical, biological concept. It's just a list of behaviors that can be caused by anything under the sun, from a normal child interacting with an abnormal school environment to a normal child having normal struggles at home, to a kid who hasn't been taught to read, to a kid who's being bullied. But you got to look at every child to find
Absolutely.
Out, is there anything at all going on and what is it? But I would be stronger on that jury business and say, the jury's in. No such thing as a medical disorder, ADHD.
I agree with you wholeheartedly. I think what I'm saying, Peter, is that the impression that is created for parents is that the jury's out. Well, actually, that the jury's in, and it's the other way. That's the impression that they're given, and it's misleading.
Absolutely.
It's completely and utterly misleading. It's dishonest, and it is, you know, it is, to me, it is an outrage, as you started your show with this evening. You know, I feel so angry that parents are being duped with this. And when are we going to get to a situation where there is honesty? That's the difficulty for me. And the problem is that people like you and I, well, I find anyway, I don't know whether you find this, are seen as oddballs ourselves. We're seen as people who are unhelpful, that we're obstructive, that we don't really have children's interests at heart at all, because if we did, we'd want to help them. We'd want to realize that this is all about helping children to succeed in life, to get the best from education so that they can go on and do whatever they need to do in life to succeed. And we are on the margins of the debate.
Vicky, we're going to go to break now. Let me just say that things are changing in the U.S. I rarely run into that anywhere I go now. When I address professional audiences, when I get calls on radio, the email we get, the calls we get, there's a real sea change in what the public feels now. And I'm not getting viewed that way at all in general. The way they tried to portray us in the beginning. When we come back from break, a couple of thoughts I'd like you to be thinking on is, first, is it harder for kids now than it was, setting aside the mental illness issues? And what's the role of drug companies? And we'll come back and talk about those issues after the break. And this is Dr. Peter Breggin. And my guest is Vicky Kopok, spelled C-O-P-P-O-C-K. My marvelous guest coming all the way from Great Britain. She's a reader in social science, childhood studies, and mental health at Edge Hill University in Great Britain. Vicky has just a tremendous dedication and devotion to the real needs of children. And when we ended, she was talking about, and I think with that feeling of that stinging feeling of being treated unjustly, that folks that hold her opinion and my opinion are sometimes treated as if we are not really interested in the needs of children. But I have actually been running into that hardly at all in recent years in the U.S. Partly, of course, that's because the psychiatrists don't ever debate me in public, so they don't get a chance to accuse me of anything in public. But it's also because there's been a real change here in the U.S., and I think that England may be interesting to talk about whether England is lagging behind, because England is just beginning to catch up with where we were a number of years earlier, and perhaps the public isn't catching on quite yet, not quite in that part of the wave yet. Vicky, what do you think about that?
I think you're right, Peter. I think there's a sense that we are behind, that we maybe this thing will kind of evolve in that way. You know, maybe the bubble will burst. I don't want to give people the impression there is no debate at all. There is debate, but it feels as though the people who are pro-ADHD are winning at the moment. That's the way I'd describe it. In spite of...
You know, Vicky, that's true here. I don't want to give a misimpression. The victory in terms of the profession drugging children is getting worse and worse.
Yeah.
But I think we are looking at a reaction in the other direction.
Yeah. I think for us as well, it's tied into another parallel sort of development in recent years, which has been this idea of there being a crisis in childhood. And I don't know, I haven't really conversed with anybody in the States about your experience of this and whether this is something that is part of the sort of public's imagination there. But we have had a series of reports and also media coverage of this idea of us being a really... But this is a dreadful place to grow up as a child. But, you know, the impression is given that that essentially the UK is one of the worst places to be a child. And that came on the back of a UNICEF report that placed us at the bottom of a league table of about 21 industrialized countries for the emotional well-being of children. Okay? And so we've had this sort of angst, you know, played out in our media debates about what's happening with children. We've got a nation of anxious, unhappy children. And that went hand... This is why it was so powerful that the... Seemingly the explanations that came from psychiatry about, yes, that seemed to be confirming that, yeah? That we've got this 100% increase in disorders as well. So it fueled this sense of we've got to do something, and maybe this is what is also fueling the drugging. And we've had a huge sort of policy push in relation to child and adolescent mental health. And at one level, you know, it would be wrong to say that's a bad thing, because while people are talking about children's mental health, for me, that's a good thing. And the difficulty is that the debate has been skewed, and it's been skewed in the direction that I was talking about previously, the direction of a mainstream medical model understanding of what's going on with our children and young people. And that's also taken attention away from what else is going on with our children. You know, why are they, if they are, even if we accept it, they are more anxious, they're more unhappy. It takes attention away from really getting at the source of what that's about. And the interesting thing is it's adults usually who are telling us why children are unhappy, and adults giving these labels and descriptions of disorder, and we're hearing little of the voice of the child. The child who is subjected to these explanations, to these theories, to the drugs, and their voices are not heard, generally speaking. And so that, for me, is the other side of my interest. My interest is in trying to write about those sorts of projects, interventions, where people are genuinely committed to children's rights in the way I understand children's rights, which is about them having a say, their voices being heard, and them telling us what they need in terms of their well-being, as well as us having this idea that as adults, we're the only people who are allowed to say what they need, us deciding for them all the time. So the rights side of things has been equally important to me. And that listening, that for me, it's all tied together with what's been going wrong. We have a culture here of not listening to children. We have a culture that where adults are preoccupied with, what we will have referred to at one time as self-actualization, of their lives, of actually seeking fulfillment in their own lives, and children being seen as maybe obstacles to them achieving that. And so children, and also parents who in the course of doing that, it might be through their career or whatever, but are not necessarily giving that time and that investment in their children. Again, there are huge expectations on parents these days, and it's not to condemn them or to say, you know, that they're bad people. This is about recognizing a pattern that is emerging in our society, a pattern whereby there's increasing pressure on parents to both go out to work in order for the family to be able to be economically, you know, okay to provide. But also there is this consumerist culture that sells this idea of lifestyle to parents, which very often doesn't include children. And those messages are very, very powerful. And what we feel as, you know, I feel has happened is that children have been sidelined in that. So listening to children at the most fundamental level is not rocket science. We don't need new theories. We know those core things that children need to grow and to develop in healthy ways, as you said right at the start of the show. And it's time, it's investment of time, and it's about relationship. It's about developing and cultivating those strong relationships with your child, of listening to your child, getting to know your child, and understanding your child. And so much has happened in recent years that takes parents away from doing that. And just another, I know we've been focusing on drugging, but I wanted also, Peter, to mention briefly my concerns about the resurgence of behavioral psychology. Because
definitely talk about that, yes.
Absolutely, because whilst drugging is for me the pinnacle of abuse, the abuses of psychiatry in relation to children and young people, equally problematic for me is the massive growth in these new programs, these parenting programs that are adopting the very, very basic core elements of behavioral psychology. And they've been popularized through Super Nanny, through House of Tiny Tearaways, through lots of these programs. Our televisions are saturated with these programs because parents are, you know, feeling out of control of their children. These ideas that fuel that ADHD diagnosis, they feel they're not in control, their children are unruly, they're getting complaints from school, all of these things. And, you know, the miraculous super nanny comes along too and sells them that idea that all you have to do is follow these simple rules and basically you can get on with your life then. Yeah, you can all get on with your busy lives because basically you follow these rules. You're far too busy to invest any more time in your children. Just do this, 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 and this, and it'll be okay. And that is just, you know, for me, equally problematic. It's equally abusive in terms of us not meeting the emotional needs of our children. And we've seen, you know, a massive, massive expansion of that. That kind of approach, a huge expansion in that approach. And there are people who are looking at it critically and, you know, writing about that critically, but those programs are as popular as ever. You know, they're on reruns. It's been, you know, all over the world. It's been broadcast all over the world, the rights to those type of programs. And they're being, you know, consumed by parents who are desperate for answers in how to manage their children because essentially they're looking for shortcuts. They're being told this is the
shortcut. They want to manage without relationship building.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that, as you and I well know, is a recipe for disaster. You do not, you know, not attending to the core emotional needs of children is a disaster. And that's how we let children down. That's how we let them down massively, by not building that relationship.
Vicki, did you in your studies get much involved with an area that always interested me a lot, and I don't get to talk with folks about it much, which was the studies done of removing children from their parents in Great Britain during the Blitz, and how it turned out that children were much better off being in bomb shelters in London with their parents than being separated from their parents to new folks out in the country. And there were also studies that the analysts were doing at that time on how early separation from a parent was really felt by an infant, that the bonding occurs early and is central to the very survival of the child. Did you happen to immerse yourself at all in those studies?
Not extensively, Peter. Obviously, they form the basis of our core theories around the development of children. The work of John Bowlby I think, the person you're referring to. And many others around that time is massively influential.
We're really losing that. We're losing track of that. But just, you know, I really agree with you about how much we're losing track of those basic studies.
Yeah, I think so. I think what happened was that some aspects of those studies were seen as problematic. Insofar as some of the assumptions about attachment were felt to be, unstable in terms of the evidence, and particularly they came in for a lot of criticism from feminism in relation to the role of mothers, and particularly the idea that attachment was about mother blaming. Basically, attachment theory was essentially about blaming mothers for for what subsequently would happen to their children. That if you didn't get it right as a mother, essentially, you know, the future for your child was hopeless. And I think that some more recent theories have used the core elements of attachment theory, I think, that Bowlby had, but have, if you like, developed them and brought them, I think fine-tuned is probably the best way of describing that. And the focus these days here is much more on the notion of resilience. What makes for resilience in children? And of course, you know, attachment to folk around them who they can have deep, meaningful relationships with is absolutely crucial. And I think some of the studies have demonstrated it's whether or not, you know, those attachments have to be biological parent attachments, or, as we know, equally, we know from adoption studies that children are still able to form really, really positive, meaningful attachments and relationships with other carers in that way. So that work has developed in that way. And that notion of resilience is I think, crucially important. What makes, and that's where, this is where, again, you know, psychiatry, I feel, gets it wrong. That so much of psychiatry is what we call deficit-focused. It's problem-focused. And so, you know, psychiatry in that sense is not about mental health. It doesn't seem to concern itself with health. It seems to always be concerned with the negative, you know, the problem. And by changing the discourse to one of resilience, we're looking much more positively. We're actually saying, and that's the direction I feel, you know, that we really need to embrace, that the idea of what do we know that makes young people resilient. So there's a whole body of work that we can draw upon that, you know, adult researchers have done in that sense, but also what are children telling us that makes them resilient? What do they communicate to us that tells us what makes for good mental health? And we've started to see some really, really good work being done in that field, listening to those children and people and hearing what they have to say. And
Let me ask a tough question, which you can sidestep if you wish, which is the issue of the influence of feminism. Are feminist scholars, and I think you include yourself in that, but let me know if you don't. Are feminist scholars looking more at some of the disadvantages of the early feminist emphasis on or de-emphasis on child rearing and the role of the mother? Is there any reconsideration going on now about seeing the empowerment of women actually including mothering? And I know it's a loaded question, and you don't have to get too much into it.
That's fine. I think the first thing to say really is that we have to bear in mind that when we use a word like feminism, it embraces a large number of perspectives. There is no one feminism. There are a number of different feminist standpoints and feminist perspectives. And so there was always a sense in which there were some feminists who were very, very strong in their arguments around rejecting mothering and rejecting motherhood and the way of doing that, you know, through the control of our fertility, as one example. But so it's never been one directional. I think the view within feminism has never been one directional on that. I think there have always been people, and I would include myself among them, who were far more balanced in an argument that says that there's a dilemma there. There's clearly a dilemma there. And I do resist and have a problem with the ways in which in some of our early theorizing, particularly in developmental psychology, we did demonize mothers, and that was problematic for me. But yet, the role of mothering is still, I would argue, so absolutely crucial. So I think there always has been debate within feminism about those things. So, and I know, for example, myself and another academic colleague that I admire very much, a guy called Harry Hendrick, he has written about this issue that I was talking about a few moments ago around this, what he would call the cult of the individual, the way in which the cult of the individual has had severe consequences for children. And in that, he alludes to the role of feminism in having negative consequences for children. So he and I appreciate some of the arguments that he brings forward in that. He feels that that's had a very negative impact, and the rejection, the idea that... He doesn't argue that women should never go out to work. Don't get me wrong. What he's saying is there's been this subtle shift in terms of adults in general, and also then the role of mothering being, if you like, devalued to such an extent that women no longer seem to to have that idea that this is something that's valuable to do in society, that they seek, if you like, their fulfillment, their self-actualization through career in a different way. And, yeah, I think he has a point. But I don't think we should sort of caricature feminists in suggesting that all feminists are against motherhood or mothering at all. And I think we also need to remind ourselves that even before feminism, the role of women in relation to mothering didn't seem to be valued very much in many respects. Women were getting the message that basically you just get on with that. You're a woman, you get on with it, you know? The status of mothering was never given a high status before feminism, and that was,
I think that is a very important point, especially among professionals and intellectuals, I would say, the status of mothering in particular, perhaps.
Yeah.
Vicki, your career is so interesting. You were trained as a social worker.
Mm-hmm.
You practiced for a time as a social worker.
Yeah.
How do you view yourself? I mean, you're so international, and your thinking encompasses many different fields. And if I were to want one or two words to put before your name in the summary for when this gets archived this evening, what are the words you use to describe yourself?
Gosh, that's so hard. Because
I thought it would be interesting, because I'm puzzling too. I mean, you're a scholar basically now, I would say.
Yeah, I am. And I think... When we had our talk before the show, you know, I was keen to sort of make sure that I got across this idea that I've always wanted, and my identity as an academic has only ever been important to me in terms of a desire to make a difference. As I did when I was a practitioner, I wanted to sort of make a difference in the lives of children and young people. And it's the same as an academic. I feel as though the impact of what I do in my research, in my writing, is vitally important to me. So, yes, I think the words before my name might be that I'm a critical social scientist now in many respects. But also I feel that I am a passionate advocate for children's rights in the field of mental health. And I hope that some of the things that I've had to say have made a difference in some way. I know in certain contexts they have. I have feedback. I have been involved directly in the development of some training materials that were named after work I did called Mad, Bad, or Misunderstood. And that has had an impact and has been used more extensively as a resource. And the core ideas that we've been talking about today within that resource, trying to get practitioners attuned to some of the questions that we've been talking about, some of the difficulties, when they...
We have about a minute and a half left. Quickly, have you been able to work at all with the critical psychiatry movement? My friend Joanna Moncrief, do you know those folks?
Yes, I do. I'm involved in the Social Perspectives Network for Modern Mental Health, which is affiliated to the Critical Psychiatry Network too. And so I have written generally about adult psychiatry too in a couple of books. They tend to focus much more on the adult psychiatry field than child psychiatry, but I do have those sort of contacts, and it's a very valuable network, the Social Perspectives Network, and we again try to take forward the social model of mental health rather than what we feel to be the very unhelpful and limiting medical model.
This has been a wonderful hour. I do want to tell folks that this is your first media in all the years.
And I was so nervous.
And you were so nervous, and you're so wonderful.
Oh,
I actually did very little talking because you had so much to say today. You have so much wisdom and thoughtfulness, and you're clearly a really empathic and scholarly person, and I'm very proud to be your first media experience. It's been a lovely hour, and I hope lots of folks are going to listen to you. And my guest Vicky Kopok, Koppock. You can Google her, and there aren't a lot of Vicky Kopocks out there. You'll be able to find her. And a quick way to get in touch with you?
Yeah, by email.
And is that on your website?
Yes, it is. Through the actual website, it's Koppock, from my initial Victoria or Vicky, at edgehill.ac.uk.
Yeah, and people will be able to get you through the Google. Again, thanks so much for being on the show.
Thank you, Peter, for inviting me.
From Great Britain. Thank you, Vicky.